Here at the eLife podcast, we try to create audio abstracts of some of the most important papers that are carried by the journal in recent weeks. But in each episode, we also try to shine the spotlight on some significant issues that are faced by practicing scientists. One of these is the rigour of peer review, where new science is scrutinised by authorities in the field before it's accepted for mainstream publication. But is this process done fairly? In the spirit of transparency, eLife made available to one of its editors, Jennifer Raymond, details of every manuscript ever submitted to the journal since its launch. She told me what she and her colleagues discovered when they analysed the data.
Well, the fundamental question is whether journals, when they review scientific papers, are finding the best science, or whether there are other factors, biases, that could be influencing the review process that journals use to decide which research to publish.
Now, when you say finding the best science, of course, journals don't go looking for publications. It's the other way around, isn't it?
Correct. The process is authors submit a manuscript that they would like to have published in the journal, and then the editors first make a preliminary decision. Is this work interesting enough or potentially interesting enough to send out to members of the scientific community for peer review? And typically three reviewers will write comments about the paper, send it back to the editors, and a decision is rendered.
Now, that sounds fair enough. And in fact, peer review is held up as the gold standard in how we should do things. So what's your beef with that?
The problem is that scientists are people, and we know that people are influenced by all kinds of cognitive biases.
So can I paraphrase by saying then I get your paper and I decide, for whatever reason best known to me, I don't like you, so I'm actually going to can your paper. I'm going to say it's really bad, it's got lots of methodological flaws or whatever, and I'm going to say let's kill it, let's not publish it.
Sure, that can happen. What we found in this study is more that people tend to give kind of an advantage to people who share certain characteristics with themselves.
Gosh.
And those characteristics include gender and nationality.
That's quite a claim. So how did you actually do the study? Let's look at the method first, and then we'll actually look at the results. So talk us through how you approached this.
First of all, we were very excited to get access to these data, every manuscript ever submitted to the journal eLife since its inception. First of all, we did what has been done a number of times, look at the differences in success rates of authors with different demographic characteristics, women versus men, people from the US, UK, Germany, China, Japan. So we asked, what are the differences in success rates? But there can be differences in success rates that are not reflecting bias, because it may be that papers coming from certain groups are just of better quality, either because they've had certain advantages like access to research resources or time or encouragement or other kinds of things. So seeing differences in success rates doesn't mean there's bias. And conversely, equal success rates doesn't mean there's no bias, because it could be that one group was actually better but had the equal success rate. So to try to get beyond that, we looked at how successful men were when reviewed by all male reviewers versus reviewers of mixed gender, and how successful they were when reviewed by reviewers from the US versus other countries.
And just to be clear, when you say success, that's a paper gets sent to the journal, it passes muster and ends up in print.
That's right.
And what does that show? When you feed these data through your sieve, what trends come out?
Well, what we found is that the decision that the reviewers made about whether a paper should be published was not just influenced by the contents of the paper, but it was influenced by the demographics, by the gender and by the nationality of the authors, and by the gender and nationality of the reviewers. Male reviewers were more likely to accept a paper from a male author. People from a given country were more likely to accept a paper from somebody from their own country. So we call this homophily.
Was it just that one-way street? Was it just men favoring men, or did women tend to give more benefit of the doubt to other women authors?
There was a suggestion that it may be the case that women also give the advantage to women, but there were not enough cases of papers from women being reviewed by all female reviewer panels, because women are highly underrepresented at every stage of science. And in fact, we found that they were underrepresented as reviewers too. And when I say underrepresented, I don't just mean that not 50%, I mean compared to the number of women in the scientific community, they were invited to review papers less often than their male colleagues.
It's about 30%, isn't it? If you look at the workforce, about one in three scientists is female, two in three are male.
That's right.
And that's going to inevitably be reflected if you think about, well, that's the pool of expertise we've got to rely on. It's probably going to be reflected in editorial boards and review panels and refereeship as well.
It's worse than that. We see that women are less represented as reviewers than they are as authors. So the author pool should be the same as the reviewer pool. And so we find that there's even less representation of women than we'd expect based on how many of them are submitting papers.
So you find that there's this homophily effect. Men look after men, women look after women. Does that apply regardless of who else is in the author list? So if you've got, say, a female first author, but a male senior author, does that skew things, or does it all ride on whether there's a woman's name there?
We did not find any effect of the gender of the first author. And it's really the senior author, kind of the head of the research laboratory, whose gender matters. And that makes sense because I think often the reviewers know the head of the lab, but might not know who the graduate student or postdoctoral fellow is who's doing the research.
Is one interpretation of that then that if I work for a female senior author and I send my paper off, I'm male, I nonetheless might face a publication bias against me owing to the fact they've got a boss who's a female?
That's true. It looks like papers coming from a given laboratory are influenced by the demographics of the senior author.
And these were statistically significant differences?
These were statistically significant differences, yes.
But obviously a statistician knows that that could mean if you do a big enough study, which you did do a huge study here, it's thousands of papers, you can detect a very, very tiny difference. So how big was the difference in practical terms?
What we saw was overall manuscripts submitted by female scientists were accepted at a rate of 13.6%, whereas 15.4% of the manuscripts from male researchers were accepted. So, you know, some people have said, well, that's tiny, that's 2%. Why are we worrying about that? But if you think of it another way, it means that the papers from the women are being accepted at only 88% the rate of the men. So there's kind of a 12% success gap there. And the effects are even bigger for some nationality effects. So, for example, papers from scientists submitting from China had a success rate of only 4.9% compared to 22.3% for researchers from the U.S.
So, should peer review go double blind? What do you think? Jennifer Raymond there. Her manuscript, if you want to take a look at the complete study, is currently available on BioArchive.